Hello, I'm David Siegelstein. This is number 0585, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0585. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Gary Whitgriff, who is the author of Destination North Pole, about his 5,000-kilometer bike ride from South Dakota to North Pole, Alaska. What was the inspiration for the trip?
About 10 years ago, my wife and I, and she's an active bicyclist, we were on a fairly long 5-day bicycle ride with a large group of people, and we had breakfast with a guy one time in his early 70s, and I looked at him and I go, wow, you're in pretty good shape. You bike a lot. What's your most interesting bike ride? He says, well, when me and my brothers biked up to Alaska to see our other brother. And so ever since then, I wanted to bike to Alaska.
Annie Sternisco is a PhD student who is studying the psychology of those who believe in conspiracy theories.
The psychology behind conspiracy theories is obviously very complex. And there's basically, in psychology, there are different streams of research on why people believe those conspiracy theories and why they're attracted to them. And you can basically categorize them into four areas.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman. And on this edition of Book Banter, we mark the 40th anniversary of Terry Fox and his Marathon of Hope with Forever Terry, A Legacy in Letters. So bring your courage and hope as we remember a great Canadian later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0585, was David Siegelstein, who is a friend and also an old colleague from back in the day at both CFCF-TV and CFCF-Radio. Thank you very much, David, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And let's start off by talking about the election. No, not that one. 58-year-old Nikolai Loktev, the incumbent mayor of Povolikino in Russia, asked the woman who cleans the city hall to add her name to the ballot as a formality in order to comply with the regulation that elections must have two or more candidates. In a twist of fate, however, Maria Odgodskaya received 62% of the vote compared to Loktev's 34% back on September 28th. I didn't think people would actually vote for me, Marina said, but one village shopkeeper explained, if we could have voted against all, we would have done, but we had the option to vote for Marina, so we did. I think she'll cope. The whole village will help. Loktev is sporting a stiff upper lip. I'm not upset. People voted for her, so let her do the job. I don't know. His response sounds a little passive-aggressive. Maybe now the cleaning woman will really clean up City Hall. Maybe the outgoing mayor can take her old job. Wouldn't that be a Freaky Friday kind of thing? Traffic slowed to a crawl and people got out of their cars on a busy roadway in Chongqing, China on October 17th, hoping to collect banknotes that were raining down from the sky. As it turned out, the money wasn't coming from heaven, but from an unnamed 29-year-old man who was tripping on methamphetamine in his 30-story-high apartment overlooking the street. As he showered passersby with money, police arrived and took him into custody, and he was receiving treatment. I'm just curious. What if he wasn't on meth, but just decided to throw money out of his window? Is that really a crime, or is it just the meth part? Also, have you noticed that whether you're in a capitalistic society or a communist one, the reaction to supposed free money by the general population is basically the same. Yeah. Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission officers were doing routine inspections in Conch Key when they noticed something odd about the man on the boat. A significant bulge in his pants. When they confronted 27-year-old Jerry Pinson, he allegedly admitted he had stuffed several lobsters down his pants when the officers weren't looking. He was arrested, charged with petty theft, possession of lobster tails, and possession of one undersized lobster tail. Oh, I hope the lobsters were alive. And for the record, I'm sure guys like Jerry, who stuff things down their pants, hate to be arrested and charged with crimes that are listed as petty and undersized. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a man from Dublin, Ireland, got off the train he'd taken to Cork and noticed he no longer had the bag he had been carrying. He tried to get back on the train to find it, but security wouldn't let him. Someone, it's thought to be the same man who lost the bag, called the Garda, the Irish National Police, to report the missing bag. Only then did he remember he had made a stop after getting off the train at a store on McCurtain Street, so he went back there. Luckily for him, store staff had found the bag and they gave it back to him. Not so lucky, the Garda found him there, and unlike the store staff, they looked in the bag. Darren Barnwell, who had a clean record up until that point, pleaded guilty to possessing the contents to supply it to others. It was cocaine. An analysis found its value was 40,000 euros. And unlike the helpful people in the store, the Garda won't return it. You know, if you're that absent-minded, perhaps drug dealing isn't the career move for you. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Author Gary Whitgriff is a very ambitious guy. He is an inventor with 6 patents, a military intelligence veteran, an internationally published researcher, and so many other things I could list. He also found the time to write a book about his 5,000-kilometer bicycle ride to the North Pole. That would be North Pole, Alaska. The book is called Destination North Pole, and Gary joins us via Skype from South Dakota. Hi, Gary.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for hosting me today.
What do you do in your downtime? I'm almost afraid to ask.
I like writing, especially when the snow is flying. And this spring, when we were cooped up, I was in the mountains of western South Dakota with my wife, and I finished this book, Destination North Pole.
Wow.
5,000 kilometers by bicycle. It was happened 2 years ago when I turned 65, and I just decided to finish writing it. But, Peter, I twisted it a little bit to make it an armchair read. Rather than just a bicycle trip for bicyclists looking for a long-distance ride, I made it basically an armchair read for, a little humor, some of the dangers that I experienced. And I think people enjoy it even if they can't get out.
Well, what led to this bicycle trip in the first place?
Oh, boy. About 10 years ago, my wife and I, and she's an active bicyclist, we were on a fairly long 5-day bicycle ride with a large group of people. And we had breakfast with a guy one time in his early 70s. And I looked at him and I go, wow, you're in pretty good shape. What you bike a lot. What's your most interesting bike ride? He says, well, when me and my brothers biked up to Alaska to see our other brother. And so ever since then, I've wanted to bike to Alaska.
So the little knowledge I have of world geography, I know that to get to Alaska from where you are, you got to basically come through this country, Canada.
If you're bicycling, I could take the ferry, but I wasn't going to take the easy way.
Yeah.
What people don't realize that from Pierre, South Dakota, you would pronounce it Pierre, South Dakota, capital of South Dakota, it's actually closer to Greenland than it is to North Pole, Alaska, which is north central Alaska, just below the Arctic Circle.
Okay. So what were the, first of all, from how long did it take to travel on this expedition of yours? And I'm assuming you did it at the most perfect climate time in the summer. So from when did you start to when did you reach your destination?
Well, Peter, I was an agronomist as part of my career, and so I studied not only weather but crops and growing seasons. And so I wanted the two longest months of the year. I figured it'd take me 2 months. So I left on May 20th thinking I would get up there. In fact, had motel reservations in Fairbanks, Alaska on July 20th. And so it gave me the longest days of the year with obviously summer solstice in between, because my goal was to bike every night until I found a clean bed and hopefully food.
So how many kilometers did you do roughly per day?
It varied by day from as low as 20 kilometers, where I staged for a longer run. This was in, I think, northern BC. And my longest was 267 kilometers in Saskatchewan. But my average was 121 kilometers a day, or stateside, we'd call it 75 miles. 121 kilometers a day
again,
for 40 days.
Again, my limited geography, I know you have to come through Canada, as I say. And also,
yes.
You basically have to hit a mountain somewhere along the way.
Actually, 8 mountain ranges. They're all in northern BC, across the Yukon, and then into eastern Alaska. And so the Alaska Highway, or the Can-Am Highway, runs around, people call it the northern end of the Rocky Mountains. But yes, I definitely did. I went through the Dakotas and come into southern Saskatchewan, went across northwest across Saskatchewan and Alberta, and then into northern British Columbia, across the Yukon, eastern Alaska, into North Pole, Alaska. And people ask me, why you call it Destination North Pole? Well, I wanted to bike to Alaska, and our nephew, niece, and their three daughters live in North Pole, Alaska. So I go, okay, my destination is North Pole.
Gotcha. What was the most difficult part of the journey?
The difficult part, I had only put on about 7 kilometers testing my GPS unit before I left. And so I was in good enough shape. I'd hiked over the winter and I hadn't been on my bike in 8 months. But I found that the physical part wasn't the stressful part. It was inattentive drivers, all the animals that I potentially could encounter. And I'd literally seen hundreds of black bears and grizzly. Most of them were grazing dandelions, actually, on the roadside borders in BC. Hundreds of wood bison. A moose come face to face with me on the road. So those are the kinds of things that I write about, and the reader will find, I think, very interesting.
You said your wife is also an experienced cyclist. Who had the better time of it?
She did. No, we tell you the truth, we both did. We both did. She stayed back for our Memorial Day because of a family situation. And so I took off fully loaded with, what was it, around 125, 130 kilo. And a couple weeks later, she caught up with me in western Saskatchewan. I took my bags, clothes and food and all that, and threw supplies, threw that in our vehicle. And then she went ahead every day to find nightly food and lodging. And so she would travel at her own schedule, made the 5,000 kilometers as her own separate trip, which obviously could be a separate book. But it was wonderful, each of us exploring on the way up there through territory we had not been.
Now, how did you plot the actual travel? I would assume you, before you even took off, you decided where you were going to go and which roads you were going to take. Were you on secondary roads? Were you on highways? How did that work out?
I planned the route as a bicyclist. You want the easiest route. So I planned it for level roads as much as possible, and to give me condition before I got to the mountains, to have a wide enough shoulder. And I'm very, very pleased with the width of the highway shoulders, even on secondary roads in Canada. Some are, of course, very narrow shoulders on rural roads. But I tried to avoid big cities, number one. The biggest I went through is Regina. And I tried to avoid routes that took heavy truck traffic.
And during the time that you were doing this ride from Dakotas all the way up to Alaska, what was the one area that really took your breath away when you looked up and said, wow, this is a picture-perfect moment of scenery?
That is a hard question because you're obviously a broadcaster, and I certainly appreciate it, but I found that by wearing earbuds, I tried it 2 days because I was fearful of weather. I did not wear any earbuds or listen to any music or radio or anything. I listened to nature. And as a military intelligence guy, I spent 4 years basically with headsets trying to differentiate signals. And I did the same thing, only trying to differentiate nature all the way up. Every day, I left about 5 in the morning. Most mornings, about 5 in the morning. It was calm. I didn't have as much wind then for the first couple hours. And the sounds that would come out, whether it be birds or insects or brush, or I trained my ears to make a game of it, which vehicle was coming next. And so was it a truck? Was it a camper? Was it a car? Was it a truck pulling a trailer, whatever? And then when it go by, I would go, I was right. And that turned into basically a mental process to obviously take the ditch if somebody was hitting the rumble strips too close behind me. Mm-hmm. So that was the danger part, but the simple beauty of every day, can't wait to see what's out there next.
One of the things, when somebody, especially considering you are clearly, when you're doing this, you're doing it professionally, you've got your gear with you. People, when they see you, know you're a serious cyclist. Did you come across other cyclists on your journey? And what's the camaraderie like if you did?
I rode against the wind. The wind comes from the west, northwest, and the Dakotas, and west out of the Prairie provinces. I basically went into it. Most wise cyclists, and a lot of those were foreigners out of Europe and Japan even, they're coming the other way. So the cyclists I met all started in Anchorage or Fairbanks and were coming towards me. So yes, I would see them at rest areas, and all of them were heavily loaded with gear. And as I mentioned, my wife met me in Western Saskatchewan. I, after that, had a stripped-down bike. It was just me and my old 10-year-old bike. And so carried enough water to last me about a half a day. And my average day, by the way, was just over 8 hours a day of pedaling. And it was just wonderful meeting these people that were moving, probably a third less speed than I was. And, interest in where they started, where they're going, how fast, where they're camping, what they're doing.
Physically, when you finished, how were you? Did you lose any weight? Did you gain any muscle?
It was just less than a half a kilometer. Did my muscles change? Certainly. I said kilometer, kilogram. I lost 1 pound. I left at 183 pounds. I got up there at 182. So I didn't. I've been in pretty decent shape all my life, so I never really trained for it, and that's why I started with 70 to 100 kilometers a day, and then as I got farther into, as I mentioned, Saskatchewan, I ended up 267 kilometers was my longest day, just going to a motel room.
Has this sated your desire to do long-distance cycling or encouraged it more, and if so, where do you want to go next?
I don't consider myself an endurance guy. I just wanted to do that, and I'm a writer. I've written several books, other books, in my Relating to Ancient series, and I just decided that this is another fun read. People can read my other books on culture and learning, and project out what's going to happen, especially with the current situation. And I just decided that this is just another fun way of people sitting in their living room and or evening reading a book. So my goal is not to do another challenge, but really to maybe put out another fun book.
I get the feeling that back in the day when things were normal, you were the life of the cocktail party.
My wife and I have retired in 2012, and we've been all over the world. We have an orphan girl we sponsor in Uganda, so we went there last year and seen her. My grandfather was born and grew up in what was called South Russia at the time, Ukraine, so we went over there. Our son worked in Australia for a couple of years, and we went to see him. Our daughter sponsored a girl in Guatemala, and so we went down there and helped them build a house. And so we just travel all over, and so we have interesting stories. And this is just another interesting story. It happens to be Destination North Pole.
One last quick question. With somebody who does so much and loves the outdoors, have you been affected in any way, shape, or form by the current situation with the pandemic?
It allowed me to finish this book. I finished it that way. It was actually a very, very positive thing. People can treat any situation as negative, but you have to look at life as positive. And that's why I like to bring out the humorous things. And was this bike ride a struggle? To me, it was a happy journey. I just couldn't wait to get on it. And if your viewers want to go on to YouTube, just type in Destination North Pole or my last name. And it's the first thing that'll pop up, and they'll get actual clips from my cell phone and my wife's of the scenery, of the sounds, the birds in the ponds. It's just one way of actually being a part of it. And of course, I'd ask them to look at the book too on Amazon or any other place.
And the book is called Destination North Pole. Gary, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you, Peter. You're an excellent host, and I appreciate you hosting me today.
Gary Whitgriff, author of Destination North Pole. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0585, and you'll find the link to Gary's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about conspiracy theories, plus Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere and on all your devices. For instance, you can hear it on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. And you can also find it on several fine radio stations, such as WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, WLSL LPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and CKHR Hay River in the Northwest Territories, just to name a few. Thank you very much to all of you for joining into the show, and don't touch that dial. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Police chases are a spectator sport in Los Angeles. They're broadcast live by Southern California TV news stations. KNBC's News Chopper 4 was following a chase in rush hour traffic where the suspect vehicle was able to get well ahead of the police, so well ahead that the driver, wanted for theft from a Home Depot store, took the time to stop for gas as the News Chopper crew televised it live. He even paid inside, presumably to get the cash discount. The driver returned to the freeway where police caught up to him again, but apparently he managed to escape. Okay, it's one thing for the cops on the ground to lose someone during a car chase, but on open roads, how do you shake a helicopter? Yeah. And a woman who would not leave a St. Petersburg, Florida mobile gas station was arrested for trespassing on October 14th. But that's not the weird part. 33-year-old Melinda Lynn Guerrero was also charged with providing a false name to law enforcement after she repeatedly said her name was "My Butt Just Farted." Officers were familiar with Guerrero from a series of arrests over several years, and her last name is tattooed on her back. So, they noted she may have been under the influence of alcohol and/or drugs. I just feel for her having to go through the pain of having her back tattoo removed so that she can replace it with Miss Buttfart. Oh, the agony. You know, in these troubling times, we need a story that just makes you feel good, and this might be it. 49-year-old Sugar Good, who manages a Dunkin' Donuts store in Edmond, Oklahoma, knew a good man when she saw one. Every morning at 7:15, as he collected his sausage, egg, and cheese croissant at her drive-thru. After a year of friendly commercial exchanges, Good finally got up the nerve to hand 45-year-old John Thompson her business card, along with his food and coffee. 2 years later, on October 13th of this year, Good and Thompson tied the knot at the place that brought them together, the Dunkin' drive-thru. "We knew we wanted to share it with the Dunkin' family," Good said. She stood at her spot in the window, and Thompson drove up in his red truck, where former pastor Colby Taylor was waiting for them. Taylor kept the ceremony short as other customers were lined up behind Thompson, but at the end, Good came outside and Thompson got out of his truck for their first kiss as regulars, friends, and family cheered them on. "Our story wasn't glamour," Good said, "but it was true romance." Ah, yes. That's a sweet story. And by the way, I hope she keeps her maiden name, though, because a woman who manages and works at the drive-thru at Dunkin' called Sugar Good is just sweetness, joy, and marketing nirvana that money cannot buy. And finally, on this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a woman attempting to elaborately dine and dash from a Burnaby, B.C. restaurant found herself in an embarrassing situation instead. Call it a dine and drop. A newly released video by Burnaby RCMP, which was taken in March of 2020, shows the woman attempting to leave without paying her bill by crawling into the ceiling vent in the woman's washroom. Police said the manager of the unnamed restaurant called them, and when officers arrived, they went to the kitchen as the woman could be heard crawling above the ceiling tiles there. And she didn't make it much further and fell through the ceiling right in the path of an officer who then arrested her. Now, I've seen the video. I mean, she hit that floor hard. For her, there was no escape. But look at the bright side for her. There's also no escape from prison food either, but at least there, she won't have to even think of paying for it. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Annie Stranisco is a PhD student at the Van Bavel Lab, which is in the Department of Psychology at New York University. Among the things that are studied there are false beliefs and conspiracy theories. Annie joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Peter.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program. I saw an interview, a news feature with Jay Van Bavel, talking about false beliefs and conspiracy theories in relation to the U.S. elections. But this is not just an issue that is election-based or on the right or on the left. So taking the election out of the equation, let's get to the root of the issue. Generally speaking, where do conspiracy theories originate and how do you go about studying them?
Good questions. So the psychology behind conspiracy theories is obviously very complex. And there's basically, in psychology, there are different streams of research on why people believe those conspiracy theories and why they're attracted to them. And you can basically categorize them into four areas. So one is that people just want to understand the world, and we all want to do that. And conspiracy theories are attractive because they explain the world and they can explain any sort of event, even though it is actually random. They give you a narrative and make the unexplainable explainable. So that is really attractive about conspiracy theories. The other one is somewhat related. We call it an existential motive, which is people's desire to find meaning in the world and to be in control of the world. And again, there's research findings supporting the idea that if people are striving for that, they tend to be attracted to conspiracy theories. Another one is, and I think that becomes very clear at the moment in how it is covered in the media is that there's a huge social component, right? Like it attracts people who are longing for belonging to a group, who want to join forces to achieve a goal. You know, like with QAnon, you see that there's this entire movement and people have these, they have like these rituals to become a warrior for QAnon. So there's a social component. For example, this idea that QAnon is so popular, that's actually totally overblown. It just gets so much attention in the media, but it's not necessarily that popular. So there's sometimes a mismatch of like how popular conspiracy theories actually are, given that now they get so much media attention. And then the fourth one is that people want to feel special and unique. So believing in conspiracy theories basically entails the idea that there's a secret plot that no one really sees. We are all sheeples, but people who believe in conspiracy theories, they tend to, the narrative tends to ensure a sense of feeling special and unique. You are seeing what other people don't see. You have access to the secret information that other people don't have. So we find in research that people who are deprived of this feeling of being special and unique also tend to turn to conspiracy theories.
The one thing I've never understood about conspiracy theories, at least the most of them, the biggest ones that are out there, is that it would take so many people to make this conspiracy work that it just doesn't seem to make any sense. I'll give you one perfect example. The people who don't believe that man has gone to the moon. Thousands of people would have to be involved with that hoax for it to work. And I just can't imagine how people would believe that theory.
That's actually an interesting point, because that is one thing we in research struggle with. I think you pointed towards that earlier, that how do we study that, right? Like, what is a conspiracy theory? Conspiracy theories are basically neutral, right? It's like it's a theory that there's a group of people that is conspiring. So we can't really know whether it's right or wrong. So like with the moon landing, conspiracy theories are not falsifiable. So we can't 100% tell and prove that we were on the moon if people don't trust the evidence. So that is a problem we are struggling with. And it's interesting that you're bringing up the number of people who have to be involved in order for it to work, because there's some research that is basically created that mathematical model showing of how long it would take for a conspiracy theory to actually be proven as true, given the number of actors that were involved, right? Because there were conspiracies such as Watergate that actually were true, right? So that is a very interesting observation that you have there. And I think the point is, it doesn't make sense to believe certain conspiracy theories. But given the desires that I just brought up, the need to belong to a group or to feel special, that just overpowers people's desire to be actually accurate in their reasoning and to truly understand the world. We all have that, right? Like that we don't want to see the flaws of our partner, our own flaws, because we're so motivated in seeing ourselves in such a positive light. That like what you observe as being an irrational belief of like, so many people would have to be involved in this moon landing conspiracy. Like, how can you possibly believe it? People might not want it to be true.
One of the things I had heard as a theory as to why conspiracy theories tend to take hold goes back to the days of when there was a conspiracy theory around the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Those who believe that more than one person was involved, those that believe that he wasn't even killed at all and that he was still alive somewhere on a hidden island. Is it part of the reason that the trauma of some situations are so devastating that it's hard for some people to believe them as happening, therefore they concoct a theory as to how it didn't happen?
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely true. So people, I mentioned that earlier, people want to be in control, and having such an event, or there are a lot of conspiracy theories about Princess Diana's death. So it's like it's something so dramatic and unexpected that it really shakes ourselves, like the idea of something so big can happen and we are not 100% in control of the world around us. So that is really triggered by these kind of big events that are unpredictable. So yes, you're exactly right. And then there's also some research which I think is interesting showing that we as people have this tendency to think that a big event has a big cost. So the idea that Princess Diana just like died via this random car accident, or that John F. Kennedy, that there was this one man who just shot him, that's not satisfying enough. Like that doesn't, we can't compute that with our ideas that a big event has to have a big reason, and conspiracy theories around those events, of course, give it a lot of, make it like a big cost in that sense, right? It's like this huge conspiracy that happened. And that is also a part that plays into the formation of those beliefs when those events happen.
You are studying at NYU, but you actually come from Europe. You come from Germany. I'm just curious to know if conspiracy theories are something that take greater hold in one part of the world more than another. For instance, are Americans more prone to conspiracy theories? Are Europeans more prone? The list goes on and on.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, too. There's not a ton of data out there. We do actually have some data that we're going to publish soon, so stay tuned. But in general, conspiracy theory beliefs are very universal, so we observe them in all sorts of contexts and countries. They do vary a little bit, but overall, polls show that conspiracy theories are also very popular in the UK and in Germany. What is interesting, though, is that oftentimes the conspiracy theories that are popular in the US, for example, about the moon landing, are also popular in Germany, and there the motivation is different, right? It's like, it's not a conspiracy theory about the own government conspiring. It's about the US government conspiring. So it's a little bit of a different flavor here, but overall it's a very universal phenomenon.
And very quickly, you mentioned earlier about social media. Is social media making the situation of conspiracy theories worse or amplifying it? And if that is the case, does that make them more difficult to beat down?
That is a very interesting question, that there's not enough data out there to know that. Social media, of course, is like fairly new. So there's not a lot of research on whether that's actually the case. It feels like it, right? But actually, if anything, the data shows that that is not the case, that conspiracy theories have been fairly popular over the past decades. So I can't really speak to that, given that there's a lack of data. For sure, we do observe just with misinformation in general that it does spread faster on social media than true information does, but we don't know how that impacts the actual adoption of these beliefs. So even if conspiracy theories really travel so fast on social media and faster than correcting information, we don't know what the outcome of that is. So it can go either way. Like there has to be more data on it, because there's also research showing that once you're exposed to conspiracy theories, you tend to, you know, like you sometimes think like, oh yeah, that is weird. And then you get the information that kind of corrects this conspiracy theory. But oftentimes once people believe it, it's hard to undo it. So that is something problematic about social media, that it just exposes people to so many conspiracy theories so quickly. But it also exposes people to a lot of correct information, right? And like it is a huge resource of learning how to evaluate information more critically, right? So like, we don't know.
I think we'll end it on that, because I've always said part of the problem is we don't necessarily teach critical thinking like we used to back in the day. It's a very fascinating topic. Annie, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Annie Strunisko, a PhD student at the Van Bavel Lab at New York University. They do some interesting studies, which you can learn more about by going to their website. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0585, and you'll find the link. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And on his way in his cross-country run, here is Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And my legs are tired. I only ran about maybe, 5 kilometers? Yeah, 5 kilometers. I need a break.
Wow, only 5 kilometers?
That's why I'm here with you.
That's a long distance. That's a long distance between the fridge and the couch.
Yeah, and my library too. That's another 5 kilometers right there.
Okay.
Well, on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to take a special look back 40 years to an event that was a milestone for any Canadian who was around back in the spring and summer of 1980. And so, because you know what? For a period of 143 days in the spring and summer of 1980, in which Terry Fox, a young man from Port Coquitlam, BC, and his Marathon of Hope in aid of the efforts towards a cure for cancer and cancer research, created a sense of excitement across Canada and amongst Canadians that hadn't been experienced since the country celebrated its centennial 13 years earlier. Now, his mission was simple: to run from Newfoundland to British Columbia, covering the distance of a typical marathon race every day, and raise the equivalent of $1 for every Canadian, which at the time in 1980, the population was about 24 million people, so that cancer can be beaten. Now, although the cancer that cost him a leg returned to his lungs, which forced him to abruptly stop his Marathon of Hope in Thunder Bay, Ontario, Terry Fox is still revered by Canadians, and the legacy he created still lives on. Terry Fox runs take place across Canada around the world every September and raise millions of more dollars for new innovations and treatments that will lead to that cure for cancer. Now, Darryl Fox, Terry's younger brother, who accompanied him throughout the entire duration of the Marathon of Hope, is the keeper of the flame that is the Terry Fox legacy. And to mark the 40th anniversary of this simple yet very monumental event in Canadian history, he has put together a special book that is quite the fitting tribute called Forever Terry, A Legacy in Letters, in which author proceeds will directly benefit the Terry Fox Foundation. Now, this book is a collection of 40 letters written by 40 Canadians who either met Terry, witnessed a Marathon of Hope in 1980, or were profoundly inspired or motivated by what Terry Fox accomplished during those 143 days, which was done against many odds, whether it be logistically, physically, or emotionally. Now, the list of contributors for this book is quite impressive, ranging from celebrities, athletes, journalists, friends, or average Canadians who were inspired by Terry to make a difference in the world in their own right. The stories are simple, well-told, inspirational, and shows what the power of a very superhuman act by one person can have on the rest of humanity. Now, for example, some of the letters that are in the book, there's one written by hockey legend Bobby Orr, whom upon meeting Terry in Toronto, they had a nice little comparison, exercise in comparison. You see, Terry showed Bobby his prosthetic leg that he used to run during the marathon, and Bobby showed Terry his much operated knee that sort of shortened his hockey career. And then there was this Edmonton Junior High School teacher, Darren Park, who retells his successful battle with an aggressive brain tumor that led him to become the organizer of the Edmonton Terry Fox Run. And then there's retired Ontario Provincial Police Officer Mary Hardesty, who escorted Terry and his small entourage during a brief portion of his run in Ontario and proved to be such a strong example when she was at her son Raymond's side when he successfully battled leukemia. And Raymond now is currently a tireless fundraiser for the Children's Miracle Network. And you add to that an impressive collection of rare, candid, and never-before-seen photos taken before, during, and after the marathon. And you have a book that is a wonderful tribute to the courage, bravery, and endurance of a 22-year-old from British Columbia named Terry Fox, who simply wanted to run across his home and native land in order to transform cancer from a deadly scourge to a disease that can be treatable and conquered. And thanks to Forever Terry, we can proudly say that the Marathon of Hope was, and still is, not just a brief shining moment for Canada and the Canadian people.
You know, I've got to mention, I had the pleasure of meeting Terry when he came through Montreal. I was producing the morning show at FM 96 at the time, and he came into the radio station, and he was just an unassuming, sweet, and humble guy. And when you consider the fact that because he was doing this cross-country run and trying to raise money for cancer, he was stopping in at every television station, every radio station. So by the time he got to us, this was probably no fun. And, you know, at 7 o'clock in the morning, before he starts his run through our part of the country, it can't be something that he wants to do. But he was gracious, and he was engaging, and he was just so warm and likable.
Well, I know what you mean, because I had my encounter with Terry also, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. But it was when I was in Ottawa for the Reach for the Top National Playoffs, and this was at the end of June, and we had a reception with the then Governor General Ed Schreier at Rideau Hall. And after all the formalities were done and the protocol and everything, there was a reception. So it was in the tent room, beautiful place. So I was walking around, sampling the fair and looking at the portraits of the old governor's general. And I see there was all of a sudden this big fuss. And all of a sudden there's like TV cameras and boom microphones and camera lights. And I'm wondering what's going on here? What happened? So I decided to walk by to the crowd, and there was Terry Fox with Daryl and the entourage. They were there to just, say hi to the governor general, and some of the kids from Reach for the Top got to meet him and was filmed. I just got to witness it, but I remember very vividly that he said that he was hoping to complete the run by November of 1980. And I remember when he left, he was there for like maybe 5-10 minutes, a loud round of applause and an ovation greeted him, sent him on his way out of Rideau Hall. So I guess we have our encounters with Terry, and it still sticks in my mind 40 years after the fact.
Absolutely. And again, this week's book is?
It's called Forever Terry, A Legacy in Letters, and it's edited by Daryl Fox, published by Viking Press, and it's $29.95.
And what other books in this genre do you recommend, sir?
Well, they're both about Terry Fox, and these are two of the definitive books on him. One is a definitive biography called Terry Fox, His Story by Leslie Scrivener. It was published in 1981, and Leslie is a journalist who followed Terry throughout most of the run. So you get a story of what is, about his boyhood, his illness, what led him to do the marathon, and also the marathon from beginning to the unfortunately shortened end. It's an excellent book. I do recommend it. And also Douglas Copeland, the novelist, who's from Vancouver, who coined the phrase Generation X. He put together a book about Terry just called Plainly Terry, and it almost looks like a museum exhibition catalog. It has pictures of some of his artifacts, his leg, photos that tells the story of Terry the person and the Marathon of Hope. It's almost like, the picture of the Marathon of Hope in 100 objects, but less than that.
Again, okay. And again, this week's book
is called Terry, Forever Terry, A Legacy in Letters by Daryl Fox. It's published by Viking Press, and it's $29.95.
And how can you be found, Mr. Nelman?
Well, not running along the Trans-Canada Highway, that's for sure, even though it would be for a good cause. But in the pages of the Montreal Times, published every week, in print or online at www.ntltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter. All the best.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We've got a few more Stuff File news stories here for you. And, of course, an idiot of the day here on a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. The Finnish airline Finnair began selling its business class airplane food in supermarkets on October 13th in an effort to keep its catering staff employed as well as offer a taste of nostalgia to travelers grounded by the COVID-19 pandemic. The ready-made Taste of Finnair dishes include reindeer meatballs, Arctic char, and Japanese-style teriyaki beef, and cost about $12. Marika Nieminen, vice president of Finnair Kitchen, said the idea allows the airline to create new work and employment for our people. Yeah, finally, a meal that doesn't come with the smell of jet fuel or the need for an air sickness bag. But I'm sure people who buy the food will finally notice that somehow the meals appear to be smaller when eaten on the ground. And often when we talk about people who are stopped by the cops in their car, they usually don't have a valid license. Well, this is the ultimate version of that scenario. Your license is suspended, an officer told 28-year-old Emily Owings of Enid, Oklahoma, after pulling her over for a traffic violation. I didn't know that, Owings told him, but she really needed to go because she, well, needed to go. I have to poop so bad, she said. She also said, it's my birthday. It's my bleeping birthday. When he told her she was under arrest for outstanding warrants, she yelled, F you guys, and sped off, leading a pursuit at over 70 miles per hour. When officers finally got her stopped again, she surrendered when she saw that they all had her at gunpoint. Once in handcuffs, Owen had one last question. Can I poop in your car, man? Okay, let's be honest. If she didn't do that when she was at gunpoint, it's not really an emergency. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
On October 8th, as an Advent health worker checked visitors' temperatures at Disney World in Orlando, Florida, she noticed a woman removing something from the stroller she was pushing and place it in the bushes outside the entrance to the park. The woman then proceeded through the checkpoint and into the park. The witness alerted authorities, who found a purse and inside a handgun. The woman, Marcia Temple of Georgia, returned to the spot and told the officers the purse was hers, but threw her 6-year-old son under the bus. I had told my son to hold it for me and stand right here while I go and get my brother. He put it down and messed with the plants, and I put them back, but I didn't know he put it down and I didn't know he left it over here. Unfortunately for Temple, security cameras captured her planting the purse in the bushes. Orange County deputies said the firearm was fully loaded, and Temple did not have a concealed weapons permit for either Florida or Georgia. She was charged with carrying a concealed firearm. Now, why, oh why, would you think that you could conceal a gun on the grounds of Walt Disney World, the friendliest place on Earth, and also the most surveillance place on Earth? Then, when you're caught, you have the level of family values that would allow you to throw your own 6-year-old kid under the bus to authorities? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0585. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0585. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.